Your conversations. All right. Well, it looks like some of you came back again this week. You always wonder about that when you're giving a two-part presentation. But then you also have to wonder, did they come back on purpose or did they just forget who was giving the sermon? I can't answer that one for you. But in any event, you're here, so unless you should happen to remember at some point there's someone with whom you need to reconcile, you're kind of stuck. Fortunately, though, there's no Greek grammar this week, and everyone but Denny, I assume, is excited. Brotherhood Mutual, where I work, actually has an employee-led chapel service, and I recently gave a couple chapel messages there. I say a couple messages, but it was really one message split out over 2 weeks, sort of like my sermons this year. And in order to try to make sure everybody was engaged and paying attention and hopefully enjoying themselves at least a little bit, I did something that birches don't usually do to start the second message. That is, I shared something personal. And they all seemed to enjoy it. And so since I once again find myself on part two of a two-part message, trying not to lose the audience, I thought maybe I'd share that material here. All right, so this is a picture of Nicole and me. You could probably tell that. This was taken at a wedding last fall, not ours, in case anybody was wondering. It's a pretty good picture, I think, or at least that's what they tell me. I don't really know how to tell, but I suppose that makes sense. Nicole looks good, but she always looks good. And I don't look any more idiotic than usual, as I don't think. Now, there is something interesting about this picture, though. And it's not just that the vest kind of makes me look fat, or it might just be my fat kind of making me look fat. I never know how to tell. But this is something fairly subtle. It will become clearer, though, if I first show you this picture. So this picture is from our engagement photo shoot. And no one who looks at this picture pays any attention to me, and thank goodness. And after all, why would you want to? But if you did, you'd notice a few things. First, Nicole's way, way out of my league. In fact, we're not playing the same sport, but that's okay. You already knew that. You might also notice the grease spots on my elbow and on the back of my right arm. It just so happened that about an hour before this picture was taken, I finished changing the rear shocks on Nicole's van, and I thought I got all the grease off myself, but I was wrong. And now it's forever immortalized. You might also notice that it looks like I'm raising my right eyebrow. Now, I'm not actually raising my right eyebrow, or at least not intentionally. In fact, I can't raise my right eyebrow independently of my left. I can raise the left one by itself, but I can't raise just the right eyebrow. However, when I was 3 years old, there was an unfortunate incident involving Beck, a doorknob, and my face. Now, to be clear, I'm not saying it was Beck's fault for closing the door on me right as I was running into the room, but I'm not saying it wasn't her fault either. The long and the short of it, though, was a quick trip to the ER, because this was back before Andrew and I had realized that it's really not that hard to stitch somebody, and six stitches. I don't remember a whole lot of it. My memory of it's kind of hazy, but my dad tells me that the whole time at the ER, I sat there like a real tough guy and refused to cry. Some things never change, I suppose. At least I came by my psychopathic tendencies, honestly. But I was left with a permanent scar and some puffiness above my right eyebrow that, when I'm viewed from the right side, makes it look like I'm raising that eyebrow, particularly in bright sunlight where my tendency to squint exaggerates the effect. And once you notice this, you can't unnotice it. It shows up every single time. For instance, in this picture. So this was taken in Colorado on top of Red Mountain, just a few minutes after Nicole and I got engaged. We're on top of a mountain. We're happy. We're sweaty. Nicole managed cleverly to get her ring into the picture in a way that doesn't look awkward or really, really intentional. And I look like an idiot who's raising his right eyebrow. Or this picture. So this was taken last year at the summit of Long's Peak in Colorado, which, in case anybody was wondering, is a fantastic hike. If you're looking for a good 14er, I really recommend it. But anyway, we'd been hiking since 2 or 3 in the morning, and we got to the top. We're tired, we're sweaty, we're elated. We were really wishing there was a slide back down. And yet, Nicole still looks fantastic, and I still look like a doofus who's raising his right eyebrow. Or there's this one. This was taken on our honeymoon in Hawaii on a dinner cruise along the Napali coast of the island of Kauai, right as the sun is setting behind us. And it's a little tougher to make out here since our faces are in the shadow. But if you know what to look for, you'll notice it still looks like I'm raising my right eyebrow. And now that you know what's there, if we go back to this picture, you see it immediately, right? It's there every single time. So I suppose this entails that your experience of this sermon could differ depending on where you're sitting. For everyone on this side of the room, I just look like my normal, vaguely irritating self. But for everybody over here, I not only look vaguely irritating, I also look confused. So you're welcome. Feel free to adjust your seating based on which version you prefer. So now that we've got that out of the way, I suppose we should actually move on to our passage for this morning. So by way of brief recap, we can move on from that. Or in case you missed last week, we've been looking at Matthew chapter 5, verses 21 through 28, which is the portion of the Sermon on the Mount containing six sections where Jesus introduces a teaching on a topic based on a verse or theme from the Old Testament using the phrase, "You have heard that it was said," or a derivation from that, and then contrasts it with his teaching on the topic, which he introduces with the phrase, "But I tell you." We noted last week that the context of this passage indicates that in employing this tactic, Jesus is not abolishing or abrogating the Old Testament law. He specifically tells us that in the verses just before this section. Rather, he is likely correcting flawed interpretations of the law put forward by the Pharisees and the scribes. We also noted that the structure of the Greek that is translated, "but I tell you," indicates that Jesus is stressing the I. He is emphasizing himself as the source of authoritative teaching on these matters. I was talking with Denny after the service last week, and he said that when he learned Greek, they were taught to translate constructions like this as "I myself." So if you prefer that to italicizing, bolding, and underlining like I did last week, feel free to read it that way. But do keep that in mind as you read those sections. And then we work through Matthew chapter 5, verses 21 through 30, which are the sections of the passage on murder and adultery. So we're going to pick up this week in verse 31 with the topic of divorce. So reading from the NIV, Jesus says, "It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, makes her the victim of adultery, and anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery." All right. First, we should note that in this case, Jesus is not actually quoting from the Old Testament law. The passage on divorce he's alluding to here is Deuteronomy 23, verses 1 through 4, which reads, "If a man marries a woman who becomes displeasing to him because he finds something indecent about her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, gives it to her, and sends her from his house, and if after she leaves his house he becomes the wife of another man, and her second husband dislikes her and writes her a certificate of divorce, gives it to her, and sends her from his house, or if he dies, then her first husband, who divorced her, is not allowed to marry her again after she has been defiled. That would be detestable in the eyes of the Lord. Do not bring sin upon the land that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance." We should also note that Jesus gives a much fuller treatment of divorce in response to a question from the Pharisees that is recorded in Matthew chapter 19. We would do well to keep that passage in mind as we look at Jesus' words here. Those of you who have attended Tech for some time will recall that a number of years ago, the elders addressed the topic of divorce and spent considerable time on that passage, and I would refer you to those sermons, which are still available on the website. To summarize briefly, though, during Jesus' time, there were two main schools of thought regarding divorce. Followers of the rabbi the internet was split on how that should be pronounced, taught that divorce was only permissible in cases where one party violated the marriage contract through sexual immorality, desertion, refusing to provide for the needs of one's spouse, or things along that line. Followers of the Rabbi Hillel, in contrast, interpreted the indecency referenced in Deuteronomy 24:1 very broadly and taught that a man could divorce his wife for virtually any reason, even something so trivial as burning a meal. It's reported that Rabbi Akiba even taught that finding another woman more attractive than one's wife constituted something indecent in her that justified divorce. So it is this context in which Jesus is speaking. And we should note also that at the time of Jesus, this more lenient view, which allowed divorce for virtually any reason, was the dominant one. In Matthew 19, Jesus is asked by the Pharisees whether it is lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason. Jesus doesn't really answer the question. He first cites God's original design for marriage as the permanent union of one man and one woman. When pressed by the Pharisees as to why Moses then permitted divorce at all, Jesus responds by essentially saying that divorce should not be necessary. If humans were not sinful, there would be no divorce, but it was permitted as a concession due to our hardness of heart. And he adds that anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another woman commits adultery. We don't have time to get into all the details here. And again, I would refer you to the sermons from several years ago for those. But there are very strong reasons to believe that what Jesus is doing here is siding with the Shammite school regarding divorce, that divorce is not justified for any and every reason, but only in cases where one party violates the marriage contract. So now back to our passage this morning. Given that the approach of the Hillel school was the dominant one, Jesus' listeners would have been accustomed to hearing that divorce is permissible for virtually any reason whatsoever. Jesus tells them that this is not the case at all. If we accept the explanation of Jesus' teaching from Matthew 19 that I just briefly laid out for you, and if we do Jesus the charity of assuming his views on divorce don't evolve like a contemporary politician's views on pretty much anything, Jesus is telling his audience that divorce for any reason except violation of the marriage contract results in adultery. God does not recognize unjustified divorces. When a man divorces his wife for an illegitimate reason, in God's eyes, the link is not really broken. As a result, if or when, as Jesus' words here assume, the woman remarries, both she and the person who she marries are committing adultery. Note that the blame for this is laid upon the man who divorced his wife without justification, not upon the wife. So once again, we see that Jesus is correcting distortions of the Old Testament law that have been propounded by the Pharisees and teachers of the law. In a society in which finding another woman more attractive than one's wife constituted grounds for divorce, Jesus rejects the sophistry of the teachers of the law. He does not here explicitly cite God's original design for marriage as the lifelong comprehensive union of one man and one woman, but it is implicit in the position he stakes out. What God has joined together, let no one separate. Here in the 21st century, where divorce is permitted for any reason at all, or no reason, and divorce rates barely differ between those who profess to be Christians and those who do not, Jesus' views on divorce are probably no less radical than they were when he first spoke this, and every bit as critical. All right, continuing on to the next section. Jesus says, "Again, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'Do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you have made.' But I tell you, do not swear an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is God's throne, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. All you need to say is simply yes or no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one." The first thing we should note here is that much like divorce, oaths should not be necessary. Ideally, we should all be so honest and reliable that nothing further than a yes or no is ever needed. But we have not proven ourselves to be of quite such quality, and as a result, oaths exist because of our fallibility. The Old Testament law recognizes this and permits, or even in some circumstances, requires oaths, even oaths in God's name. God himself uses oaths. Is Jesus then overturning this? As we've seen with all of the examples up to now, the short answer is no. The longer answer is still no, but it comes with a little bit of elaboration. First, as we've noted a few times already, Jesus is fond of categorical, unqualified proclamations. So we might suspect that we have something of that type going on here, and I think that we do. But there's more to the story than just that. And this is another area where some familiarity with the social and cultural context is important to understanding what Jesus is saying. As we all know, with an oath or a promise comes the expectation that one will keep that oath or promise. And this can sometimes be inconvenient. Anyone here ever made a promise that you found it inconvenient or difficult to keep? A few of you, I have. Apparently, the Jews had a similar experience, because by Jesus' time, there was a veritable cottage industry around the topic of oaths, specifically dealing with which ones were binding and which ones were not. That sounds funny, but that was in fact the case. In fact, the Mishnah, which is one of the Jewish code of law books, contains multiple tractates devoted to the topic of the relative validity of various kinds of oaths and detailing which ones are binding and which ones are not, which ones you have to keep and which ones are more sort of optional. And a lot of these distinctions turn on seemingly tiny, insignificant details. D.A. Carson cites, as an example, a rabbi who taught that if you swore by Jerusalem, you were not bound by your oath, but if you swore towards Jerusalem, you were. Got that? That's important. By or toward. Does this sound just a little bit convoluted to anybody? But this was the situation. And given the sheer amount of ink spilled on the topic, it was undoubtedly fairly nuanced. But the gist of it seems to have been, in general, that if you swore by God's name, or explicitly or by something very directly tied to it, you had to keep your oath. But if you swore by something else, well, there were more actual guidelines. Presumably then, if you were a savvy Jew, you would employ different oaths on different occasions depending on whether or not you had any intention of keeping your word or wanted to be bound by it. A culture that deemed this an acceptable practice, Jesus tells his hearers not to swear at all, and it's no wonder. Note again that he specifically mentions not to swear by heaven, the earth, or Jerusalem, and connects those items back to God. His hearers likely would have regarded such oaths as non-binding, since they were not oaths made explicitly in God's name. But again, Jesus will have none of this sophistry. Even our hair, though it is on our heads, is not ours in the sense that we cannot directly control it. There would be probably, I assume, a lot fewer bald people if we could. And I would have a sweet fro. Instead, Jesus says we should simply let our yes be yes and our no, no. This general issue of truthfulness is what Jesus is really addressing here. He uses the topic of oaths and perversions of them to set up the discussion and expose the distorted teachings of the Pharisees and scribes. But the point he's making is ultimately about keeping our word and not specifically about oaths. Thus, the Christian who interprets Jesus' prohibition here literally, and there are those who do, and as a result refuses to be sworn in a court of law, but doesn't honor a commitment he or she has made, is not actually honoring Jesus' words. He or she has fallen into the same Pharisaic legalistic sophistry that prompted Jesus to give these instructions in the first place. Going on to the next section, Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you." This is another one of those frequently abused passages. I don't know about you, but I've personally heard people use these verses to justify everything from pacifism to not defending oneself from spurious lawsuits to making two cakes instead of one for a gay wedding. Here Jesus begins by citing the principle of proportionate retribution, commonly referred to as lex talionis. It's found in multiple places in the Old Testament. Here Jesus seems to be quoting it from Exodus 21, verses 24 and 25. It's very popular nowadays in our culture to look down one's nose at this principle as barbaric and unrefined and sort of beneath us. You've probably seen the bumper stickers that say, an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. We should note, though, that the principle of proportionate retribution was not instated to mandate revenge, but rather to limit it. If someone injures me, the principle of proportionate retribution prohibits me from killing him or her in response. By Jesus' time, though, physical penalties had been largely replaced by financial ones. So if this principle wasn't really being observed in practice, if people weren't going around knocking out teeth and gouging out eyes, a la some sort of reality out of a Three Stooges film, what is Jesus intending to address? There are a couple of things that help us answer this question. First, we want to notice that every example Jesus uses is a personal one. Each deals with how individuals relate to other individuals. With apologies to any pacifists, Jesus isn't giving us a lesson in foreign policy. He's instructing us how we as individuals relate to one another. Second, we should note that in the first example, Jesus envisions a situation in which one is slapped on the right cheek. As we noted last week, roughly 90% of the world's population is right-handed. How does a right-handed person slap someone else on the right cheek? There's only one way, right? You have to use the back of your hand. Now, no one who is trying to assault or mug someone does so via backhands, at least I don't think. I've never heard of such an occurrence, which is why, in our culture, the backhanded slap is associated not with a brutal attack, but with an insult. This was the same in the ancient Near East culture to which Jesus is speaking. In fact, one scholar notes that even today in the Near East, a backhanded blow expresses the greatest possible contempt. So Jesus is not describing a situation in which we're being attacked and our lives are at stake. He's imagining a scenario in which we're insulted, treated with contempt, demeaned, dishonored, and it is this type of situation in which Jesus says we should turn the other cheek instead of responding in kind. Likewise, in the other examples Jesus gives, Jewish law dictated in a lawsuit that one might lose one's tunic, which the NIV translates as shirt. This would have been the less valuable undergarment, but the law forbade confiscation of the cloak, or translated coat in the NIV. This would have been the more valuable outer garment, and this was entirely on humanitarian grounds. If you were a poor person, you needed your cloak to keep warm. The idea in this example is then the same as in the previous one. Jesus is saying that when we are personally wronged, rather than asserting our rights and fighting tooth and nail to defend ourselves and our property, we should hold on to our rights and possessions loosely. The going the extra mile example is probably a reference to the practice of Roman soldiers who would commonly conscript civilian labor to carry their luggage for a prescribed distance. Given how strongly the Jews resented Roman occupation, we can easily imagine how they might have responded to this. In contrast, though, Jesus tells his listeners not only to perform the requested work, but to go beyond it. In such situations, Carson writes, Jesus' followers are to not feel hard done by or irritable as if personally insulted, but are to double the distance and accept the imposition cheerfully. Jesus concludes by telling his hearers to give to the one who asks you and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. R.T. France notes that the imperative give here is in the aorist tense, which may indicate that Jesus is thinking of one specific instance of someone asking, as opposed to someone who has demonstrated a pattern of asking for assistance over and over and over again. So this verse probably does not justify quitting your job and taking up panhandling, in case any of you were considering that. But in any event, the idea is the same as in the previous verses. Jesus' followers are to hold on to their rights and their possessions loosely. They are to ignore insults and slurs and endure personal abuse without responding in kind, instead demonstrating grace and a willingness to sacrifice for others. In short, we are to treat others as human beings created in the image of God, whether or not others act like it. This brings us to the last of our six sections. Jesus continues, "You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. So the first thing that strikes one, or at least strikes me, on reading these verses is that Jesus saved the easiest for last. Just be perfect, that's all. All that's required. In this case, the teaching Jesus says his hearers have heard, that is, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, does not actually appear anywhere in the Old Testament. Nowhere are the Israelites commanded to hate their enemies. However, they are commanded to love their neighbors. And apparently some Jews took this to be an exhaustive list and concluded that their neighbors were the only people they had to love. Keep in mind also that hate often signifies not actual hatred, but a lack of love or less love in comparison. Compare Jesus' words in Luke 14, verse 26, where he says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, such a person cannot be my disciple. But even taking hate in this gentler sense will not satisfy Jesus. He's not content that we just dislike our enemies or like them or love them less than our friends. He insists on an indiscriminate love that is extended toward all. Jesus links this requirement directly to our status as children of God. If God loves all men and causes the sun to rise and rain to fall on both the righteous and the unrighteous, and if we claim to be his children, how can we love any differently? And this love cannot be limited to just our feelings. It must be demonstrated in our behavior, as Jesus indicates by commanding us to pray for our enemies. This is not sappy sentimentalism. This is an earnest desire for the good of others, even those who hate us. Jesus has sharp words for the one who would love only those who respond reciprocally. Are not even the tax collectors doing that? I'm sure none of you need to be reminded how offensive the average Jew would have found this. The IRS may get a bad rap nowadays. Can I get a taxation is theft? But this is nothing compared to how the Jews felt about tax collectors. The Romans, again, as I'm sure you know, employed what was essentially a tax farming system. In the various regions they occupied, they would set quotas for how much tax was to be raised, and then they would rely on volunteers from among the local people to go out and actually collect it. Anything those people collected above what they were required to turn in, they could keep. The Romans didn't care if you collected more than was required, as long as you didn't collect less. And because the people actually collecting the tax were from the community in which they were collecting, they knew the people, they knew who had money, they knew who didn't, and they were able to extort the rich people more effectively as a result. Thus, tax collectors were doubly loathed by the Jews, first because they were sellouts working for the occupying Roman forces, and second because they extorted and robbed their own people. But as Jesus points out, even the tax collectors loved their friends. If we do no more than that, how are we any better? Likewise, even pagans and Gentiles, on whom the Jews also looked down, greet their own people. This leads then to Jesus' command in the final verse of our passage, which we could fairly say sums up everything that has preceded it. Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. The righteousness surpassing that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law that Jesus requires of his followers is just to be conformed to the character of our heavenly Father. The Greek word translated perfect here is teleos, and it carries the idea of perfection in the sense of completeness or something achieving its intended purpose. It's the same root from which we take words like teleology or teleological, when, of course, the teleological argument has to do with evidence of design and the universe. In essence, then, Jesus is calling us to nothing more, but also nothing less than that for which we were designed and intended. As human beings created in the image of God, we are to be imitators of our Father, including, or perhaps especially, in the way we love. All right, so having worked through our passage, let me offer a couple of general thoughts on it. First, we should again make note of Jesus' authority. As we noted last week, Jesus is doing something here more or less unprecedented, something rabbis just didn't do. As he corrects these mistaken interpretations of the law, Jesus grounds his interpretations not in citations from other teachers or evidence from the Old Testament texts themselves, but simply in the fact that he is the one offering them. This would be an unconscionably presumptuous, arrogant thing to do if he were not himself God. Carson expresses this very well, writing, "Jesus' authority is one of the most dominant features in this chapter. The law and the prophets point toward him, but he himself determines their meaning, fulfillment, and continuity, with an authority nothing less than divine. It is important to remember that the Old Testament scriptures have no intrinsic status apart from God. Whatever authority they possess is derived. But because the derivation is from God, it takes nothing less than divine authority to interpret and define it in this way. Implicitly, therefore, Jesus is claiming such authority for himself." Banish forever from your mind the idea of Jesus as the gentle, moral teacher wandering the Jewish countryside preaching love and acceptance. If Jesus was not actually God, then he was undoubtedly one of the most pretentious, megalomaniacal persons ever to walk the earth. In the spirit of C.S. Lewis's famous liar, lunatic, or lord trilemma, let me offer the following. Jesus was either God, or he was full of himself. Second, we should observe the approach of the Pharisees and teachers of the law that Jesus is opposing here. We can pretty much sum it up in one word. That word would be legalism. The Pharisees and the scribes seem to think that God's requirements could be reduced to a system of rules that, if assiduously observed, would curry God's favor. In doing so, they failed to understand or appreciate the spirit of the law. They missed the forest for the trees, or, as Jesus tells them later, they strained out the gnat, but they swallowed the camel. Unsurprisingly, Jesus will have none of this. Instead, he offers his own interpretations, which, as we noted last week, are simultaneously less literal, but more accurate. What he requires is both much simpler and much more difficult. Not to live by a laundry list of rules and regulations, but just to be perfect. Again, Carson puts this so well, I'll risk another extended quote. He writes, "That toward which the law and the prophets have pointed has come in the person of Jesus and in the kingdom or saving reign which he introduces. Jesus authoritatively makes plain the demands of the kingdom and how they stand in relation to the Old Testament scriptures. The common demand is holiness, perfection. All the Old Testament laws are rightly understood only when interpreted in the light of this overwhelming concern. The emphasis on transparent purity and unaffected holiness, on imitating the Father's perfection, utterly precludes all religious hypocrisy, all spiritual sham, all paraded righteousness, all ostentatiously performed religious duties." Now, we could go through each of the six topics from our passage and evaluate ourselves in light of them. How are we handling our anger? Are we holding on to grudges, or are we forgiving others? Are we guarding our hearts against lust? How are we responding when we're insulted? Are we praying for our enemies? And so on. These are things that we should be thinking about and questions we should be asking ourselves. But I will leave it to each of us to answer these personally. And I think we should be careful about how we go about doing that, lest we end up falling into the same legalistic trap that snared the Pharisees. It is important to get it right, if you will, in these six areas, but it's not sufficient. If we've learned anything from our passage, hopefully we've learned that we can't just replace the legalism of the Pharisees with a system of rules of our own invention. The goal is not just to get these six areas of our lives right, but to bring our whole lives into submission to Christ. And as such, any approach that says, just give me the list of rules I have to keep, has already missed the point. If Pharisaism didn't work for the Pharisees, it's not going to work for us. However, in Matthew chapter 22, Jesus did give us two commands that sum up all the others. Matthew 22:34-40. Hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, the Pharisees got together. One of them, an expert in the law, tested him with this question. "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" Jesus replied, and you know these words, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments." If we make these two commands our focus, if we can find a way to do these two things, we just might find that all the rest gets thrown in. Amen? All right, at this point, I think one of the elders is going to come. Oh, Nate is going to come and close us. Thank you.